Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and how can we as New Yorkers aspire to a more racially integrated school system? And what is a realistic expectation for diversifying our schools? We're asking these questions as part of our series, Power Lines, Race, Class, the City, and its Schools. The series has been looking at the connected issues of segregation and the perceptions behind what makes a good school. How does a good school get that label? WNYC's coverage of the rezoning of two elementary schools in Brooklyn highlights the issue of how families divided by race and class live close together but do not send their children to the same schools. Here's a father from Dumbo calling in recently who doesn't want his daughter rezoned from the overcrowded, mostly white and more affluent public school 8 that she attends, that's overcrowded, as I say, to another one in the neighborhood, 307, that has mostly lower income kids from the projects, but has a good reputation and plenty of seats.
The reason that the real estate here is so high is because of that school. The same with Tribeca. It's very expensive there because of the wonderful school that they have.
So, Jim, hypothetically, if the DOE were to announce this rezoning plan tonight and it rezoned your child into PS 307, what would you do?
I'd probably think about a private school. It's and it really is troublesome because PSA is really a pretty good public school. And here,
because
you know,
why? You just heard our last caller. What is it that you would be afraid would happen to your kid in 307?
I think the very much like the woman who had taken her child out of that school and put the child into a charter school. We would be afraid that the kids around wouldn't have that kind of preparedness that he is surrounded by now.
One Dumbo dad, and this tendency to want to avoid mostly black and Latino schools even extends to this caller, a black dad who called in the other day who felt bad taking his daughter out of a mostly black school that is so good that President Obama singled it out in a speech for praise. He sends her instead to a largely white gifted kids school, and he has regrets.
Well, she's in a great school, but I felt my reason for putting her in that school was not, you know, genuine. I know McDermott has a great program, a great math program, albeit 6 days a week, but it's a great program. But we decided, you know what, perception is reality. If she goes to an all-black school, they will look at it, you know what, possibly could she have learned there.
So with those two callers as backdrop, today we talked to Clara Hemphill, who mapped multi-ethnic New York City and found that even when the population of a neighborhood is mixed racially and socioeconomically, in many instances there are schools in these neighborhoods serving high concentrations of low-income students of color. Clara is founder of Inside Schools at the New School Center for New York City Affairs now. Clara, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be here.
And you created a map to see if segregated schools are just a function of segregated housing. Is that a standard theory?
For decades, school officials and researchers have blamed segregated housing for the segregation of the New York City public schools. And we found that it's true that housing is segregated in New York City, but we discovered that even in integrated neighborhoods, we often have segregated schools.
So, for example, an example from the Times write-up of your study, it says, take Public School 36, the Margaret Douglas School in Morningside Heights, right in the backyard of Columbia University and many of its faculty members. According to the 2014 American Community Survey, that's the census, the median household income for the school zone was nearly $69,000 a year, and 37% of its residents were either black or Hispanic. But at PS 36, the New School report said, the median income was $36,000, and the student population was 90% black and Hispanic. So what does that example tell you?
That example says that we have the potential for integrated schools even without changing the zone lines.
Because there was a relatively high average income and a relatively high amount of diversity in the area. But in the school, the student population was 96% black, Hispanic, and pretty poor.
It also tells us that a certain number of parents are voting with their feet. They live in the school zone, but they don't want to send their kids to that school.
Let's see. There are some other examples here. Here's the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School release on this, or from your report. In Harlem, the estimated household income of children enrolled at PS 125 is barely half that of all the households in the school zone. Based on median household income, estimates from that most recent census survey finds PS 125 pupils are 84% black and Latino. The proportion of black and Latino people living in the school's attendance zone is just 37%. So another example. So, listeners, do you live in a neighborhood with diverse housing but segregated schools? Call in and tell us your experience and why you think that is, and what someone might do or policy might do about it. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So you heard the clips of the parent callers, Clara. Many white parents, I think as articulated by the first caller, might say, we live in the city. We like diversity. We want diversity. We live in a diverse neighborhood. But if a school has predominantly kids who are poor and won't have the preparedness to learn, and that's the word he used in the clip, not race or income, but preparedness, then he's disadvantaging his daughter. It's unfortunate that poverty and its effects still fall so much along racial lines, but that's the obstacle that so many white city parents perceive and feel. So how do we get past that to integration? Do they compete as priorities and needs? Because you'll acknowledge that there's an underlying concern there that's real, right?
There's certainly an underlying concern, which is real. And I think once you've bought an apartment in a good school zone or a zone that's perceived to have a good school, it's very, very difficult to change those school lines. It's very difficult to change those zone lines. Changing zone lines is always politically fraught, especially when you have big disparities in schools. It's a little easier when you're reassigning children to a school that's seen as a comparable quality. But what we're saying here is that there are already people who've already bought their apartments or rented their apartments in school zones. Persuading them to send their kids to the schools is a lot easier.
Do you have success stories?
Oh, there are a lot of success stories. For example, PS 125 in Harlem, right now there's an interracial group of parents who are working very hard to diversify that school. There's a Japanese dad, an African-American grandma, and a Chinese mother, all of whom think that they want a more progressive school. They think that's what Harlem is missing. They don't want what they see as the very traditional military style of the charter schools. They want something a little more progressive, a little more friendly, a better balance between play and work. And these parents have worked with the principal to make the school much more progressive. So in the very early grades, we're seeing some changes at that school.
Let's take a call. Jonathan on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jonathan.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Thank you, Brian. I wanted to throw in a little positive note here. I'm a parent of three children. They're all in the public school system. We started with elementary, CTE 1 over on the east side in Harlem. Then they went to middle school in our neighborhood, which is on 109th Street and Broadway. That was Mott Hall 2, and now they're in different high schools. All of those schools are extremely integrated. And I think, for example, my two boys, they go to a high school which is math, science, engineering. It's the most, even though it's one of the so-called specialized schools, it's the most integrated of the eight specialized schools in New York City. So it's up to the parent. The parent has to inject their own sensibilities and ideas into this crazy equation. For example, the G&T program, if you look at them, some of them on the west side of Manhattan, for example, are all white and black schools. So we decide not to go to those G&T programs because that's not what we wanted. This is New York City. Thank you.
Jonathan, thank you very much. So as a matter of policy, I asked Mayor de Blasio when he was on the show recently how his administration is addressing segregation in the schools, and here's part of what he said.
We address that through school choice because the middle school and high school level, there are so many choices for our children. It includes, in many cases, going into different communities and learning with kids of a whole host of backgrounds. We certainly address it through our affordable housing plan. When you're talking about affordable housing for 500,000 people, we're open to other options in the admissions process, but essentially it's our affordable housing program. It's pre-K, it's after school, it's high school and middle school choice.
So what do you think about that list, Clara?
I think school choice often makes things worse. I think that the most affluent parents tend to figure out how to apply to the schools. The application process is very complicated, and the lower income parents tend to sign their kids up just the day before school starts to go to their local school.
We heard the example, I think, from our caller of how a parent who is dedicated to finding both diverse and good schools for his kids could do it, but it takes that kind of work that we heard from his story that he put into it.
I also think that middle school and high school is really too late because by the time the kids get that old, the gap between the haves and have-nots is so huge that it's really hard even for very talented teachers to bridge. That's why we're focusing on pre-kindergarten and elementary school in our research because we think there's a better chance to bridge the gap at the younger age.
David in Crown Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, sir. How are you?
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you. And I wanted to say I'm a lifelong New York City resident, and I've been to public schools my whole life, and I'm watching. I just moved to Crown Heights from Bushwick, and I watched the whole gentrification process, and I think...
And you're a teacher, is that right?
I'm a martial arts teacher, so I'm freelance. Oh. I go to public schools, and I also go to very affluent private schools, including Avenues, which is, I believe, $45,000 a year in Chelsea,
okay.
Right across the street from a housing project.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think the housing project kids are basically those schools that they go to in Chelsea. I doubt those kids that go to Avenues that their parents ever dreamt that their child would end up in that school, that public school that's being filled up by all those children from the housing project. So that's just one example that I see in my daily life.
And what's the point of your story or the recommendation that flows from your experience?
Well, my experience is that when a person buys an apartment, let's say right now in a Bed-Stuy, they don't have any kind of they're not really even thinking their child is going to end up in that public school. So if more and more of those people move to Bed-Stuy and buy housing, then they're either going to all send their children to a private school, which is maybe what's happening, or they'll somehow use a political or some economic power that they have their hands on and try to get that school to be upgraded because then it will be filled with all of their children. So it's like move in, fix it up, and then the people that had use of it don't get to use it anymore.
David, thank you very much.
Fear of displacement is real, and that's one of the biggest issues in the city today with gentrification, isn't it? The people who lived in neighborhoods like Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights for years and did their best to make them good communities are now being pushed out.
So if the point of your study is to demonstrate that school segregation in the city is not simply the result of housing segregation in the city, and by the way, listeners, you can see the maps. We've put a link to them on our page. Go to WNYC.org, or you can go right to the Inside Schools. Is it InsideSchools.org that Clara Hemphill runs? And you can get the link there to the maps, which, you know, kind of show you housing segregation, too, and also show you school segregation and how they overlap and not. If it's not as much of a function as housing segregation as people have assumed, what different kinds of policy responses does that result suggest?
I think leadership of each school is really crucial. It takes a rare principal who can make parents of different races and ethnicities all feel welcome and all feel valued, and to make sure that their kids are getting the best education policy possible. There are some principals who really see their goal as helping the parents who've lived there for a long time and are suspicious of newcomers. On the other side, there's some principals who bend over backwards to help the newcomers and shut out the people who've been there for years. But it's a very tricky job to balance these interests. But I think some principals are able to do it.
And how does this, in our last 30 seconds, relate to the PS8, PS307 situation that we've been covering so much? Because really, every neighborhood has a slightly different version of this, I think.
Well, as Yasmin wrote a couple months ago, that PS8 used to be in the same situation. It used to be a school which was 90% Black and Latino and had was not seen as a favored school. But it became a good principal, began to attract different kinds of parents, and it's a great school now.
Same lesson. InsideSchools.org, now affiliated with the New School. Clara Hemphill, founder, thank you very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.